Hello, and welcome to another episode of And the Winner Is, where we take a stroll back at all the Best Picture Oscar winners. Tonight, we're looking at the most recent winner until next month, which is Everything Everywhere All at Once. That's such a mouthful of a title for a film. joining me as always is Paul. You're right, mate?
Yep, not too bad. Forgot what podcast we were on then, didn't you, mate?
I did for a second, yeah. this is what happens when you don't do intros.
Yeah.
You think, oh, I don't need those anymore.
Yeah.
I clearly do.
You'd think after nearly 3 years that we'd remember, wouldn't you? But I still forget. I even forget my name sometimes.
That's just the pitfall of doing like three of them and also squeezing them together, isn't it? That's
yeah.
the trouble. Which one am I on tonight? So we're sort of talking about the most recent winner. We had to get around to it eventually. It came out of the draw, didn't we? So
yeah, we knew it had come up at yeah. some point. We're already over halfway through,
yes.
So we knew it had come up at some point.
Yeah, and probably one of the most kind of semi-commercial winners that we've had in a while, I suspect, probably.
Yeah, definitely. It's not the typical winner, is it? I would kind of put this in the same genre as The Artist. It's kind of been
yes.
a little bit of a left field. And even The Shape of Water as well, I would
yes.
throw in that category. They're all kind of similar ilk.
There's more quirky sort of winners, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Also, as we said before, they tend to sort of split into three. We have the great big epic winners, the Lawrence of Arabias, and Gone with the Winds, which we're going to do at some point. The personal ones, like the last episodes, The Hurt Locker or Marty, and then the sort of the slightly quirky one. Another one we haven't done yet, Amadeus, probably fall into that category slightly as well. And then this one's firmly in the quirky. As always, we talk about a few bits and pieces of the film. First off, the budget, the box office. Right, it had apparently a budget of anywhere between 14 and 25 million. So it's a little bit squiffy on that.
Yeah.
Punt on the box office.
This is a strange one, isn't it? Because it was kind of a hybrid of being released in the cinema and being a streaming film. Mm. So I don't think it probably made loads more than its budget. I reckon 45 million.
No, apparently 143 million, give or take.
Jesus, that's surprising considering it was one of these kind of crossover films.
Yeah, because it started with a limited release as well.
Yeah,
in March of that year, of 2022, and then it went wide in the middle of start of April. It was released by A24. So it's for what's basically a cult film. It seems more of a cult film. That wasn't a bad box office at all, actually.
no, it certainly isn't, and I do think kind of word of mouth definitely helped this. And I would say Ke Huy Quan's revival was also a major part of this.
Yeah, I think in the end it had 13 nominations, I believe, and I think it won 7. Which is not a bad return, actually. So 11 nominations, I believe it was actually. Not to be sniffed at. Michelle Yeoh won for Best Actress as well that year, which I think was great. I say Ke Huy Quan won Best Supporting. Jamie Lee Curtis won Best Supporting Actress. So it did all right on the acting front.
Most certainly did.
Yeah, in terms of the films it was up against, All Quiet on the Western Front. Spookily, a film we discussed in the last podcast briefly, Avatar: The Way of Water, The Banshees of Inisherin, Elvis, The Fablemans, Tar, Top Gun: Maverick, Triangle of Sadness, and Women Talking. And that's actually a list where I've actually seen a couple of them. I've seen All Quiet, I've seen Avatar, I've seen Banshees, I've seen Elvis, since Top Gun: Maverick. I've yet to see The Fablemans, Tar, or Triangle of Sadness, or Women Talking. So those will be on the list at some point.
Interestingly, I've only seen Top Gun: Maverick.
Yeah.
No, really not.
Yes, sir. So there's a decent list. Just one or two little bits and pieces about the film. Apparently, all the visual effects for it were only done by 9 people, with two of which were the directors. And most of the shots were done by a core group of 5 people. You would never know from watching the film.
No, you definitely wouldn't. This has definitely got... there's a lot of special effects in this. I do wonder how much practical stuff was done, though. That's the... Yeah. Definitely feels like that's the sort of thing. And kind of the special effects that you do have is it's a lot of replicating the same person in different spaces.
Yeah.
So that, I would imagine, is fairly easy to be able to keep using the same thing.
Yeah. I think, for throughout. Instance, that shot where Michelle Yeoh goes sort of backwards, I think I read it was shot like over the course of several months. It was done, I guess he must have done it a little bit at a time.
Yeah, and then just put it all together.
It's such a fantastic sequence.
Yeah.
When he pushes back. Yes, the shot of Evelyn zooming backwards features footage Daniel Kwan filmed over the course of a year at about 45 minutes into the film. That's incredible that they went back and just bits and pieces of it.
Yeah.
Ki Ho Kwan did most of his own stunts during the what the Americans would call a fanny pack fight.
Yeah, what a lot of people don't realise was he was a stuntman on the first X-Men film.
Mm.
That's what he ended up doing after because he kind of retired after Indy and Goonies.
Yeah,
and then he kind of wanted to get back in, so he threw his hat into stunt acting. And he was the stunt coordinator.
Yeah.
Or one of them on the first X-Men film. There's plenty of pictures, which is kind of why he ended up getting the job in Loki. Because obviously he had those connections to Kevin Feige all the way back there.
So there are one or two moments in the film where Andy Lee stood in for him. And they used face swapping technology to put Kwan's face on his body. That's incredible. A bit freaky. You won't watch, but I didn't film that bit. That looks. There was another one I pointed out to me. Oh yes, the writer directors Daniel Scheinert and Daniel Kwan originally intended for Evelyn to have undiagnosed ADHD. But the quote you're saying is it started as an almost insensitive idea. Like, what if the main character was so distractible they could tap into other universes? And apparently, as Kwan researched the condition, he discovered that he himself had undiagnosed ADHD. That's very spooky. One bit they didn't use, I thought was interesting. One universe that wasn't used, Evelyn was a piece of sentient spaghetti cooked in a pot. and she has a son, so to speak. It was a piece of elbow macaroni, eager to be thrown against the wall as a test of sticky doneness. So this will show he's become a man. I'm so glad they dropped that because the film was weird enough as it was.
Yeah.
In separate interviews, Michelle Yeoh and Stephanie Hsu, who played her daughter, revealed that the Rock universe was their favorite, even though neither of the actors are seen or heard in it. And we'll talk about that scene a bit more in a moment, actually. Which apparently on that same thing, that scene where they became Rocks was originally going to see them voice the dialogue. But Michelle Yeoh was the one who suggested it be subtitled, which was probably a good suggestion. And the last couple were, I wanted to point out, was James Hong was 91 years old during filming, and he had 5 stand-ins to perform his action sequences. and one stand-in volunteered to shave his head just for the honour of doubling him.
No.
And the final one back on the nominations, with its seven wins, including Best Picture, it was the most awarded Best Picture winner since Slumdog Millionaire, which we've already done, which was 14 years previous.
Yeah.
Right, so I think with that, we should go into, just to say this, I think probably both watched on Amazon Prime, I suspect.
Yes, yeah, we most certainly did. I was just going to throw out a fact as well, for anybody that doesn't know, it wasn't originally written to have a female lead.
No,
Jackie Chan was meant to play the lead, and he told Michelle Yeoh that he would rather she did it and took the lead, and they rewrote the script for her to be able to do that, which is amazing. She was kind of, obviously we've seen her in quite a lot recently. She was in Shang-Chi and a lot of like bigger budget box office hits. Obviously, she'd had the massive hit with Hidden Dragon, 20 years ago now, it must be. And she kind of was doing bit parts, and then she made her way back. And for us, obviously, she was in Star Trek, and that kind of reignited her career in recent years, and it's taken these bigger parts. And then to then have a script rewritten just so she could be the lead is quite something, really.
Yeah, yeah. If only one of the notes I'd written down in the opening sequence, it was Jackie Chan time.
So. Yeah.
So because there's that vibe throughout the film, isn't there? I did sort of, when we talk about the opening, that I thought there was a really cool mirror shot at the start of the film.
Yeah.
Just to sort of, as they sort of pan through, don't I think, as well, as we lead up to Evelyn. And the other thing I really noted out of the first sequence of the film was that Evelyn starts the film so frosty. She's not really a nice person at the start of the film.
No, very, very much so. And for those that don't know, her daughter in this is, she played a major part in the last couple of seasons of The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel. That's where I knew her from. It was, I sat there and I was like, why do I know her? And she plays Mrs. Maisel's ex-husband's girlfriend for the last couple of seasons. Obviously, that now has a connection back to us with our comic book podcast, now that Mrs. Maisel is the most famous journalist in the world.
Yes, yes, she's going to be, isn't she? Yep.
Yep.
Lois Lane. There was something else I'd written down in his opening bit of the film. Yes. Oh, yeah, so I wrote that she's rude too when she's talking about somebody having a big nose.
Yeah.
Constantly talking about that woman's nose.
Yeah.
I thought, she's so rude.
It definitely feels like you walk into somewhere like a laundrette.
Yeah.
That you can hear people talking in their own language, because that tends to be the way. And you always do wonder what they're saying about you.
Yeah. Yeah. And is that what they're doing? And it probably is. I suspect. I don't blame them. I would as well. And then, of course, we also see James Hong in that sort of this early thing. And you think, oh, that's probably where she gets it from, because he's a bit cantankerous as well.
Yeah. Yeah. Definitely.
And they are. You can see early in the film that they're very fractious, and that her husband is clearly sort of at the end of his tether a little bit. He's carrying around his divorce papers.
Yeah, definitely henpecked, I think is the term.
Yeah, yeah. And so it's quite a little bit of setup, actually, isn't it, for a 2-hour-20 film, and a film which apparently when the film first came out, it's a film about a woman doing her taxes, and there's basically that is the first section of the film.
Yeah, and it is very, it's a chaotic start, because they do try to introduce kind of everybody.
Yeah,
the only person that they don't, and I'd completely forgotten because of that, we don't see Jamie Lee Curtis for about half an hour.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it completely threw me when she appeared. And then I went, oh, of course, she bloody won the Oscar for it.
Yeah, she did.
But it takes forever for her to be introduced, so much so that I'd forgotten.
Yeah, so that first half an hour, the first act is very much about setting out the family dynamic and her feelings on where she is in the world and all that stuff. And it certainly, the film does allow itself to take its time to do that. Probably to its credit, I suspect.
Yeah.
You sort of care, it allows you to care for these characters a bit more than we sometimes would see. I was talking about Jamie Lee Curtis, the first note I got around her appearance is that I'd written her butt plugs are so weird for awards.
I know. there's some really weird moments with things of similar ilk throughout this film.
Pepper, there's that fight later on where they're trying to sit on one.
Yeah. What? And then there's another fight with dildos.
Yes.
There's some really, really strange moments in this.
Yeah.
But then there's some really great nods to pop culture as well. There's a moment where I'm convinced they're using a Mr. Fusion.
Mm.
as yeah. well. Just and it, it at times it does feel very Matrix-like. In fact, one of my notes says Matrix on steroids. Because it's just mental.
Yeah, it's just basically my notes are just made up of things like dildos, bagel. They're all one word.
Yeah, I've got bagel worship as well. Yes,
dildos, sausage fingers, bagels are all in a row. Oh, on my
the sausage fingers is just bizarre.
Actually, weird. It's so weird.
Yeah,
that whole sequence. And of course, there's that nod to 2001, which we see why they've got sausage fingers. Well, they basically, there were two sort of types of ape way back when, and the sausage fingers beat the regular one.
Yeah. As I say, there's some great pop culture moments throughout this as well. Obviously, the back break is very similar to Bane and Batman.
Mm.
We have that. There's definitely some Hidden Dragon thrown in there as well, yeah. obviously, because of her. Just really weird moments.
Well, there's also some really funny ones. There's where one of those sort of possessed sort of attackers has got the dog.
Yep, I've got that down as well.
The dog is flying across the room when I was absolutely wet myself. But I watched
yep.
the second time I watched this, and the first time I just pissed myself. It's always funny in a film to see a dog go meow
across yeah. the room. Yeah, I've also got a note that just says raccoons
yeah.
as well.
Oh, yes, Raccoon Atui or whatever he's called.
Yeah, yeah. And I have to point out, I love Key. I've never managed to meet him. He's one of the indie ones that I've never caught when he's come over. Yeah. But I did have to write down, he does have a short round moment when he shouts Waymond.
Yeah.
He's just like, no, don't go, don't do that. You're just turning into short round again.
Yeah. I like you saying about the pop cultures. I mean, that whole Ratatouille thing was a massive sequence of itself. That's just an absolutely bizarre one as well.
Yeah.
But it's interesting because this came out, of course, around the same time as the Marvel movie.
Yeah.
And you couldn't get two completely different multiverse movies at all.
No, very much so.
In some ways, this is kind of what we wanted to see from the Marvel one. Not sausage fingers and fighting dildos, but...
yeah. Can you imagine Peter Parker fighting with a dildo? smacking the Green Goblin over the head with one.
Yeah, but we wanted to see more variants and variants and just peeks into what we got other than we got in that Marvel film. And this film does that. We see that, funny enough, I thought about it with Loki. We see her in it with a normal life where she went off and had a career as a singer. We see her having that sausage fingers relationship story. And that again, that was nice to utilize Jamie Lee Curtis's character in that way as well, I thought.
Because we get three or four different versions, don't we, of that character throughout. Yeah. Obviously, we've got the basic one that's doing the taxes. Then we have the murderous one. Then we have the one that's killed.
Yeah.
And then obviously this one that's in the relationship with her. And as I say, considering we don't meet her until half an hour in, it's not a surprise that she got the award, is it? When she kind of puts in all these different versions of the character within like the space of, I would say she probably only appears in it for about an hour of the two. Because again, it kind of descends then into kind of clips of her throughout it. Whereas the main core of three, the family, are kind of a constant throughout.
Mm. And we've said this, we've mentioned this in the past, that because she's got probably the more comedic role in the film, and very rarely do the comedic roles win.
Yeah.
I think it was part of the roller coaster that won all of the awards that probably helped winning her. Because, I mean, a lot of people's money was on Angela Bassett actually winning for Marvel's first ever acting Oscar.
Yeah, exactly. And a lot of people, obviously, I think it was a very mixed year in terms of what people thought was going to win. Obviously, for a long time, everybody thought Austin Butler was going to be best actor.
Yes, yes.
And that went by the wayside really quickly.
He won the BAFTA. Won the BAFTA the previous month.
Yeah, but had lost out at the Golden Globes and the Emmys, hadn't he? And it was kind of... It was a shock when that happened. And then for him to not get the Oscar as well. And I think it was the same with Angela Bassett. I think there'd been this big hype. And she certainly did carry Wakanda Forever. There was no doubt about that. And it was a lot to carry. And I think she probably did deserve it. Mm-hmm. But I think, as you say, I think this was a case of this was a film that was just going to steamroller whatever it was put in front of it.
Momentum, didn't it?
So, yeah.
And that's because ironically, unbelievably, I think at the BAFTAs, this only won one BAFTA.
Yeah.
Which was, I think, Michelle Yeoh for the actress, if memory serves.
Yeah.
Because All Quiet on the Western Front absolutely creamed the BAFTAs the previous month. And I thought, which was quite interesting, marked difference in the way that the British Academy votes on stuff compared to the American one.
Yeah, definitely.
And I think it's been accused before. I think the American one is a lot more backslapping towards itself.
Yeah.
Than BAFTA, because BAFTA gave it to a British-German co-production.
Yeah.
And I'll say up front, was my pick for winning the Oscar as well. I've seen that film. I think it's fantastic. And I'll say that up front. I probably think it should have won. But it was quite a marked difference to see how everything always performed at the BAFTAs compared to the Oscars. That sort of 1-7. And so I was kind of surprised then when it did win in that respect that it did so well.
Yeah.
But it just shows the marked difference sometimes between Oscar and BAFTA.
Yeah. And I think, as we said up front, I think there was a combined kind of this is out of the box compared to normal. You've got comeback of a child actor that disappeared from Hollywood. You'd also obviously got the Asian element to it.
Yeah, I think that was probably I think is more of a factor in the American thinking of voting for stuff, I suspect, than the British one.
Yep, definitely. And that's not to say it wasn't deserving of being there at all. It does kind of feel like it did have some element as to how it got so much.
Yeah. But I mean, the best comparison to this for me, I think, in terms of previous winners and where it probably got that attention from was Parasite.
Yeah.
Which was about, I think, it was a Korean family.
Yes.
So it played on that whole thing about the family unit, which is another of those big Oscar themes. Again, I think probably some of that doesn't quite come in quite the same way in British voting thinking.
Yeah.
So those dysfunctional family things are really another thing that the Americans, we've seen it before with some of the other films we've discussed. Ordinary Family, Terms of Endearment, I think, as well. They've all got those dysfunctional family stories at their core. Kramer versus Kramer. That's what I was thinking about there.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. There's definitely a reason behind how it won so much. And don't get me wrong, I would probably give some of the awards to them still, even if there wasn't something behind that. As you say, probably Angela Bassett deserved Best Supporting Actress. Jamie Lee Curtis is fantastic in this. I just don't think she kind of runs throughout the film in the same way that Angela Bassett did.
There was one bit I did want to pick up on that completely threw me the first time I watched it. Is when we suddenly get the end come up on, and there's like an hour left of the film.
Yeah, I was like, what's going on? Why are we getting credits already?
Yeah. And I thought, what the hell?
Yeah.
And then to see that it was a film within a film, okay, then this is where we're going with it.
Yeah, yeah. That's when it really does. And then it kind of has a feel. I tell you what it feels like. It feels like Scott Pilgrim a little bit. Because we get all these kind of vignettes.
Yeah, yeah. So we, without the, throughout the verses as well, we just see them sort of starting to wrap up all those in that last hour, those wrap up those little sub stories.
And you even verses. You even get moments, certainly with the daughter, with her powers. It kind of feels like,
actually in this film.
She is brilliant, and I'm surprised she wasn't up there as best supporting actresses. It's interesting, but some of her moments kind of feel like some of the ex-boyfriends and things like that. It's got a comic book vibe to it.
And we've already mentioned it at the start that the scene with the stones was such a weird but also really clever. I'm watching and think, what have I been on something and I didn't realize, because it's just out left field scene. But of course, it gets paid off with all the others as well. I mean, it's such a. I don't want to sort of do it. It's such an interesting film in that there's so much going on. But it's also a really, really weird film, and it's probably the weirdest ever winner of the Best Picture.
I definitely. If this had been a decade ago, it wouldn't have won.
No.
I would probably say if it had come before Lord of the Rings, I don't think it would have won. That's kind of where I put that mark. That was a change in Oscar voting. I think since then, obviously Heath Ledger won Best Supporting Actor. And as you say, we've seen a couple of animated films nominated as Best Picture. And I think that's kind of where it's come from. So I would say if it had come before then, it would have got nowhere near winning. But now, as you say, Shape of Water and stuff like that has come along and won. And this is that kind of next step on from that, in my opinion.
And like I said a minute ago, the themes of the film as well appeal to Oscar.
While it's weird, it has got themes throughout it that
heart and soul.
The Academy
and I can see why it would have swung a lot of votes, especially because where people might not realize, a lot of the Oscar vote is done on preferential voting. So it may not have been everybody's first choice, but it may have been enough people's second choice to have got it over the line. Because that's the way that the system works on Oscar, is pref voting. So you can have lots of first places and still not necessarily win. If another film garners more seconds, so you say some of you might have a first and a third compared to a first and second. So on that basis, I suspect probably helped it as well. Like I said, in terms of wrapping up, I think at this point, purely from a cinematic and narrative point of view, and the films that I've seen out of that year, my own feeling was, and I wanted All Quiet on the Western Front to win, which I think is a fantastic, amazing piece of work, and a film that I can revisit, even though the storyline is quite grim. But with this, I've seen it and enjoyed it. I've seen it a couple of times. I don't think I'd watch it a third time. I arguably wouldn't have watched it a second time if we weren't doing the podcast.
Yeah. I don't think it's one that you want to watch in quick succession.
No.
You might go back to it in 5 years, 10 years.
Yeah. Well, I've seen it twice in a year, and it's kind of a little, quite an assault on the senses with a dildo.
Yeah, definitely.
And I say, yes, there are some nice performances on it and some great effects. It's quirky and Yowie's fantastic in it. Score-wise, again, this is a tough one for me. It's another one where I think it's all right, but it's not. I don't think it's one of the Oscar classics. And again, I'd probably give this probably a similar score to the last one. Probably another 79 for me.
Yeah, and I'm going to go with a similar pattern, but because for for some of the same reasons as Hurt Locker, but some different ones, because obviously this is a very different film. Again, great performances from people that I like. There's definitely people that are in my wheelhouse. Obviously, we're massive Indiana Jones fans.
Yeah.
So Ke Huy Quan is right up there as one of those iconic characters. And Michelle Yeoh, obviously, as we said, Shang-Chi, Star Trek, they're people that are in our wheelhouse. So similar to Hurt Locker with Renner and Mackie, they're people that we like in it.
Yeah.
We said with the Hurt Locker, it was more because it was real world. I think this goes the opposite way and possibly goes a little bit too far non-real world at times.
Yeah.
And is a little bit too bonkers and a little bit hard to follow at times.
Yeah.
So for that fact, again, it was an enjoyable film. I enjoyed watching it. I had some great fun, but again, it's not a classic. It's not one that people are going to go, oh, Gone with the Wind, everywhere, everything, everywhere, all at once. Not going to be spoken in the same breath.
No.
So for that matter, I'm going to give it the same score as I did for the Hurt Locker. I'm going to give it an 81.
Yeah.
Just because it was an enjoyable, it's entertaining.
Yeah. Yeah, we're certainly more entertaining than Hurt Locker.
Yeah, but also a little bit nonsensical.
Yeah, yeah.
It kind of went too far the other way, whereas the Hurt Locker was very, very
grounded
and probably too grounded to be classed as entertainment. This, I don't think a lot of people, despite the fact that it took all that money, I think that was there was a reason behind that, and I think probably the Oscar win was some way behind that as well. That it's not something that I think if it hadn't have had that word of mouth, I don't think it would have done that well on its own.
No.
No. So yeah, but enjoyable, but just a little bit too much.
Yeah. Right. I suppose that leaves us to sort of have a look what the next two are going to be.
Yeah.
Over to you.
Yeah. So I teased it on the Hurt Locker. our first winner is 1987 winner Platoon.
Yeah.
And then we're going a long way back.
Oh.
1942.
Lost Weekend.
No. How Green Was My Valley?
Oh, How Green Was My Valley? Right. Oh, how interesting. I've never seen that. I don't think.
No. So I teased Platoon on the Hurt Locker episode.
That's two very different films, I think.
Yep. What we like, though, isn't it? We like to see something different every month. So,
oh, excellent, cool. So, I aim to get those sort of watched up.
Well, yep.
Anyway, thanks more for
no worries,
and we'll thank you, listeners, and join us all next month.